From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I thought it was an essential venture, and I think we are emerging from it with an Iraq that has a future. Iraq had no future before this war.
Former Pentagon advisor Richard Perle speaking in 2004, but he's singing a very different tune now. Today, Neo Culpa. Vanity Fair looks at neoconservatives who say the war has been undermined by White House incompetence. Then we'll look at the case of Elisa Patterson, the third woman to die in Iraq. It's now known she killed herself after refusing to participate in the interrogation techniques being used on Iraqi prisoners. And in Nicaragua, Sandinista leader Daniel Ortega has a clear lead in the country's presidential election. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Who will run Congress? Polls have opened across the country today for the nation's most contested midterm election in over a decade. Public opinion polls show Democrats have a chance of taking control of both the House and Senate. Democrats need a net gain of 15 seats to grab control of the House and a gain of 6 seats to take the Senate. Voters will also be deciding about 200 ballot initiatives across the country. Among them, a dozen deal with eminent domain, half a dozen are on same-sex marriage, others address the minimum wage and tobacco. In Missouri, residents will vote on a constitutional amendment on stem cell research, and South Dakotans will vote on banning almost all abortion. Reports are already coming in about problems at the polls during early voting. In Missouri, the state's chief elections official said she was asked for photo identification at the voting booth on Monday, despite a court ruling striking down the requirement. Secretary of State Robin Carnahan said she found the experience to be very troubling. Groups like the Election Protection Coalition have sent election monitors to polls across the country. Meanwhile, Democratic Congress members John Conyers and John Dingell have asked the Justice Department and other agencies to investigate the Republican use of so-called robocalls. Conyers and Dingell said the National Republican Campaign Committee has reportedly spent $600,000 to repeatedly send out pre-recorded phone calls that confuse voters and are designed to generate anger at Democratic candidates. The Washington Post reported one woman from Ohio called the paper in tears yesterday, saying she could not keep her phone line open to hospice workers caring for her terminally ill mother because of nonstop political robocalls. In California, an ad for Republican Senate candidate Dick Mountjoy was forced onto the radio airwaves through the use of the Federal Emergency Alert System. Just after 10 o'clock Monday morning, KFBK, a conservative talk radio station in Sacramento, initiated the required monthly test of EAS. After the end of the standard test, the station also sent the political ad. Listeners to the community radio station KDVS heard this message Monday morning on its airwaves.
This concludes this test of the emergency alert system.
It's estimated that 4 to 10 million illegal immigrants cross into the United States every year, and they're not just coming for jobs. It's hard to believe, but since 9/11, more Americans have died at the hands of illegal aliens than died in the terrorist attacks and the war in Iraq combined.
The conservative station KFBK reportedly claimed the ad was sent out by mistake. In news from Iraq, the Washington Post is reporting Iraq's Interior Ministry has charged 57 employees, including high-ranking officers, with human rights crimes for their roles in the torture of hundreds of detainees once jailed in a notorious prison known as Site 4. The charges mark the first time the present Iraqi government has taken criminal action against members of its own security forces for operating torture chambers inside Interior Ministry prisons. More questions are being raised over the timing of Saddam Hussein's sentencing just 2 days before the U.S. midterm election. NBC News is reporting the U.S.-funded Iraqi High Tribunal went ahead with the sentencing, even though the verdict was not yet completed. On Sunday, the presiding judge did not read the actual verdict, and reporters still have not received copies. Meanwhile, a number of European nations are opposing the execution of Saddam Hussein. This is Italian Prime Minister Romano Prodi.
Italy is against the death penalty, and so even in such a dramatic case as Saddam Hussein, we still think that death penalty must not be put in action.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair addressed the issue Monday.
As I've already said, we are against the death penalty. I mean, we're against the death penalty, whether it's Saddam or anybody else. However, what I think is important about this is to recognise that this trial of Saddam, which has been handled by the Iraqis themselves, and they will take the decision about this.
The United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Independence of Judges and Lawyers says the trial of Saddam Hussein was neither impartial nor fair. Leandro Despuy said the former Iraqi president should be tried on appeal by an independent and impartial court backed by the United Nations. Amnesty International's Nicole Chari also criticized the court proceedings.
Amnesty International, of course, is opposed to the death penalty, whether it's handed down against Saddam Hussein or anyone else around the world. But in this case, in particular, the trial has been flawed from the outset. And this is what makes it even more worrying that after such a flawed trial, Saddam Hussein and two co-defendants should get the death penalty.
The Iraqi government has shut down two Sunni television stations after they criticized the sentencing of Saddam Hussein. Police raided at least one of the stations. Iraq prohibits the media from reporting on material that could incite violence. The Iraqi government closed the Baghdad office of Al Jazeera over 2 years ago, and it remains closed. Meanwhile, Iraqi leaders have agreed to a draft law that would allow hundreds of thousands of former Ba'ath Party members to start working again for the Iraqi government. In May 2003, the Bush administration sacked all Ba'ath Party government employees and then banned them from holding jobs. It was one of the first moves announced by Paul Bremer. In other news from Iraq, a third Marine has pled guilty to charges in connection with the killing of an Iraqi civilian in the village of Hamdaniyeh in April. On Monday, Lance Corporal Tyler Jackson pleaded guilty to aggravated assault and conspiracy to obstruct justice. He testified his squad kidnapped and executed a 52-year-old Iraqi man named Hashim Ibrahim Awad. Jackson said his squad leader ordered his troops to get online and fire rounds at Awad. After he was shot, U.S. soldiers placed a shovel and an AK-47 near his body to make it look like he was an insurgent planting a roadside bomb. An undercover investigation by ABC News has revealed Army recruiters are telling students that the war is over in an effort to get them to enlist. One recruiter was recorded saying, quote, "We're not at war. War ended a long time ago." When a student asked another recruiter if soldiers are still being sent to Iraq, the recruiter responded, quote, "No, we're bringing people back." In Mexico, authorities are investigating a series of small bombings in Mexico City. They exploded on Monday morning at Mexico's top electoral court, the headquarters of the PRI party and a bank. No injuries were reported. The Associated Press reports that a coalition of five leftist groups claimed responsibility for the homemade bombs. In a statement, the group stated, quote, "Our political military action is a response to our determination to reply with revolutionary violence to the violence unleashed by the lords of power and money." Meanwhile, in Oaxaca, thousands of protesters and teachers march for a second day to call for the removal of federal police from the city. One Oaxacan teacher criticized the police.
"We have a lot of colleagues who have been arrested, and some have disappeared, and we don't know where they are. They were arrested by local police and the government, so we are marching to show the conditions are not in place to return to school."
The International Committee of the Red Cross is calling for the abolition of cluster bombs. Dr. Philip Sperry of the Red Cross made the announcement Monday.
"The ICRC believes that the time has come for strong international action to end the predictable pattern of human tragedy associated with cluster munitions."
Dr. Sperry said the Red Cross will call upon all states to take a series of steps.
"To immediately end the use of inaccurate and unreliable cluster munitions, to prohibit the targeting of cluster munitions against any military objective located in a populated area, to eliminate stocks of inaccurate and unreliable cluster munitions, and, pending their destruction, not to transfer such weapons to other countries."
The Red Cross said it's stepping up its campaign against cluster bombs because of Israel's extensive use of the weapons in Lebanon. A U.S. State Department spokesperson said the Bush administration still believes that cluster bombs are a legally acceptable munition. And in Nicaragua, Sandinista leader Daniel Ortega appears set to return to power despite efforts by the Bush administration to help his opponents. With more than half the vote counted, Ortega has about 39% of the vote in a five-way race. It's unclear if the Bush administration will challenge the fairness of the vote. On Monday, the U.S. State Department claimed there were a number of procedural problems in the election, including delays in opening polling places, long lines, and stations closing while there were still voters in line. But Gustavo Fernandez, an election observer from the Organization for American States, said the vote went smoothly.
The quality of yesterday's election permits us to say they were peaceful, massive, organized, and legal.
We'll have more on Nicaragua later in the broadcast. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Did the torture of Iraqi prisoners lead an American soldier to take her own life? The question is being raised on the heels of new disclosed military documents kept under wraps for the past 3 years. Specialist Alyssa Peterson was 27 years old when she died on September 15, 2003. She was the third female soldier to lose her life in the Iraq War. Peterson was assigned as an interrogator to a U.S. airbase in Tal Afar. The military listed her death as the result of a, quote, non-hostile weapons discharge. But the newly uncovered military documents reveal Peterson actually shot herself with her service rifle. The documents also show her suicide came just 2 weeks after she refused to take part in further interrogations of Iraqi prisoners and had asked to be reassigned. Peterson had taken part in just two interrogation sessions. James D. Hamilton, Peterson's first sergeant, told investigators, quote, "It was hard for her to be aggressive to prisoners, detainees, as she felt that we were cruel to them." Military officials refused to describe what techniques Peterson had objected to and said all records of them had been destroyed. I'm joined now on the phone by the reporter who broke the story, joining us from Arizona radio station KNAU. His name is Kevin Elliston. He speaks to us from Flagstaff, Arizona. Flagstaff was also Specialist Alyssa Peterson's hometown. Kevin Elliston, welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi.
It's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Can you talk about this case and what you found and how you found it out?
Well, yeah, that sums it up. You know, she objected to the interrogation techniques that they were using at that particular base. It's interesting that it was 7 months before the Abu Ghraib scandal broke. I have to wonder if there's some connection.
Tell us about Alyssa's story, how she came to be in the military.
She got a psychology degree from Northern Arizona University on an ROTC scholarship and then fulfilled her obligation by attending the interrogation school at Fort Huachuca in Southern Arizona. She spent a year at, Fort Campbell, Kentucky, in Arabic language school before they sent her over there. She was in country for 3 weeks before she killed herself.
And talk about the documents that you were able to get.
I got a copy of the death investigation. I got a copy of the criminal investigation and some excerpts from the autopsy. I didn't get the full autopsy.
Can you talk about her family and what her family understood?
Her family didn't really want to know how she died. For their own reasons. I think they suspected that it was a suicide. I talked to her brother the other day, and he said that he suspected it was a suicide, but they all decided that they didn't want to know the details.
She was an Arabic-speaking interrogator who was trained at Fort Huachuca?
Yes.
And what further information do you have about how she went from there to Iraq? And then exactly what she was doing in Iraq?
She was in the, 110th Intelligence Battalion. It was part of the 101st Airborne Division. She did train in Arabic in Kentucky, and then they sent her over there. She was in country for 2 days before she did her first interrogation. Her second interrogation was the day after that. The day after that, she attended suicide prevention training and requested to be transferred. She said that she could not carry out the interrogation techniques that they were using in the cage, which is what they called the interrogation unit at the Tal Afar Air Base, where she was assigned. And then she was reassigned to the gate, where she interviewed Iraqi workers and monitored Iraqi guards for what they thought might be duplicitous behavior.
And is there any suggestion that she might have been killed by anyone else, or is it quite clear that she committed suicide at this point?
The military investigation concluded that she committed suicide. My understanding is that there was a suicide note found on her body, but I was unable to obtain a copy of that.
We're talking to Kevin Elston, host of Weekend Edition on the Arizona radio station KNAU, who has been investigating the case of Flagstaff soldier Specialist Elisa Peterson, who was 27 years old, an Arabic-speaking interrogator who trained in Arizona, assigned to a unit at Tal Afar Air Base in northwestern Iraq. And according to a criminal investigation report recently released by the military under the Freedom of Information Act, Peterson had been in Iraq for 2 weeks and participated in two interrogations. Any further information about those interrogations?
No, it was. I was unable to obtain any descriptions of those interrogations. And as I said, the FOIA officer for her unit said that all records of those interrogations had been destroyed as a matter of course when that unit was disbanded upon returning from Iraq.
Did that sound at all unusual to you?
It did to me, but I'm not in the military.
And her parents, her family, her brother, do they want more information?
No, they definitely don't.
Where are you going with the story now, Kevin?
I've been talking with some senior producers on my network and, doing some further investigations. I've filed additional FOIA requests, and I'm hoping to find out more information.
Well, Kevin Elston, I want to thank you very much for being with us, host of Weekend Edition on the Arizona radio station KNAU in Flagstaff, Arizona. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Back in a minute. Muslim Gauze here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As millions of Americans head to the polls today, the war in Iraq is looming large. According to a new Washington Post ABC News survey, 31% of Americans rank Iraq as the election's top issue. That's just 1 point shy of matching the total who answered health care, immigration, and terrorism combined. 53% of Americans also say the war in Iraq was not worth fighting. Well, a new article in Vanity Fair is reporting a number of prominent neoconservatives who backed the invasion of Iraq are now criticizing President Bush's handling of the war. The list includes former Pentagon advisors Richard Perle and Kenneth Edelman, former presidential speechwriter David Frum, Michael Rubin, a former senior official in the Pentagon's Office of Special Plans. Richard Perle admitted that huge mistakes were made in Iraq. Perle has criticized Vanity Fair because he claims he was promised the remarks would not be published until after the midterm elections. The article is called Neo Culpa. It's written by Vanity Fair contributing editor David Rose, who joins us now from Oxford, England, in studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!, David.
Hi.
It's good to have you with us. Well, tell us who you talked to and what they said.
Well, you've already given some of the list. Richard Pearl, Kenneth Edelman, David Frum, Michael Rubin, also Frank Gaffney, director of the Center for Security Policy. That's a think tank with very close ties to the high levels of the Pentagon, with Elliot Cohen from the School of Advanced International Studies, really the sort of flower of the neocon intellectual elite in Washington, D.C. And what a number of these individuals are now saying is that the war in Iraq has gone so badly, the situation now appears to be so intractable, and the likelihood of actually winning this war now so slim, that had they if they had their time over, they would not now be arguing in favor of military intervention in Iraq, even if they continued to believe, as indeed Richard Pearl says he does, that Saddam Hussein did possess stocks of weapons of mass destruction, or at least the capability to create such stocks, and connections with terrorism. Richard Pearl told me that if he had his time over, he would now say that that security threat to the interests of the United States should be dealt with by some other means. And Kenneth Edelman, who of course wrote the famous Washington Post op-ed about a year before the war, which said that Iraq would be a cakewalk, goes even further. He says that he has been simply crushed by the incompetence of the administration, and particularly by his old friend Donald Rumsfeld, and that if he had his time over, instead of writing that Iraq would be a cakewalk, he would say that while the policy of trying to change the regime there was correct, the execution has been so incompetent that the idea should be put, as he put it, in a drawer marked don't do too difficult rather than let's go. Well, this clearly does represent a fairly substantial shift in the positions of these individuals.
Didn't Kenneth Edelman use the term for the Bush administration of dysfunctional, deadly?
Yes, indeed. In fact, quite a number of them have used that word, dysfunctional. Not only Kenneth Edelman, but also Richard Pearl, Michael Rubin and David Frum. And what they're particularly referring to is the inability of the administration to make decisions. Of course, they advocated a particular set of policies, a swift handover to an Iraqi government. They also wanted a large number, several thousand Iraqis, to be trained to go in with the coalition forces as auxiliaries. And I do think there is a very respectable case to be made for both those two positions. If there had been thousands of Iraqi troops with the American, British and other forces, clearly there would have been interpreters for units, a much better chance of getting local intelligence. And had there been a provisional government quickly, then the war might have been seen as something more akin to a liberation, as they wanted, as opposed to an occupation. But what they're really getting at here is that when they advocated that position, as did their colleagues in the Pentagon, Paul Wolfowitz and Douglas Feith, and the CIA and the State Department argued strongly against such positions, the administration just couldn't make up its mind. So as we were sending many thousands of soldiers into harm's way in Iraq, the administration hadn't decided what it was going to do next. And as they put it, the process of interagency decision-making, the place where these kinds of disputes should be hammered out, that is the National Security Council, at that time, of course, chaired by Condoleezza Rice, it was dysfunctional and disorganized. Indeed, Michael Rubin says it was one of the worst National Security Councils in American history. This is a staggering indictment. But, of course, they also go on to say that while the NSC was dysfunctional, ultimately the buck does stop at the president. It is the president's job to make these decisions. And they say something which is perhaps even more damning. While President Bush had this rhetoric, what he called his freedom agenda, of imposing democracy, of bringing democracy to Iraq, and appearing in his rhetoric to agree with what these neocons were saying, actually he just didn't seem to grasp how you had to put that into effect. And so coming from people who took those positions, who didn't just advocate the invasion in 2003, but in many cases, particularly Richard Pearl's, have been arguing in favor of regime change going way back into the Clinton administration, really almost since Desert Storm in 1991. I mean, this is a tremendous indictment of President Bush. And indeed, I put it to Richard Pearl in precisely those terms. I said, this is an extraordinary indictment of the president. And he just said to me, yes, it is.
We're talking to David Rose, contributing editor at Vanity Fair. His latest article is entitled Neo Culpa. Tell us about Michael Ledeen. We see him on television all the time, the American Enterprise Institute Freedom Scholar.
Well, actually, Michael Ledeen is slightly different from the rest of the people I interviewed, because actually, if you look back at his record, Michael Ledeen did not strongly advocate regime change through military force in Iraq. He really was more concerned with Iran and remains so. He has consistently argued in favor of trying to change the Iranian regime, not through military force, but by supporting pro-democracy forces. However, he served on Reagan's National Security Council and saw close up how decisions were made at that time. And he is absolutely damning about the way things have gone on under this administration. He says that back in the day when he was on the NSC, it, as he put it, defined the disagreement for the president. If there were competing views held by different government agencies, then the NSC would refine those disagreements so that the president would then know what exactly the points of disagreement were, and he would take a decision, and he would do so in a timely fashion. Well, quite the reverse has happened, says Mr. Ledeen, under this administration, and he's had close contact, he tells me, particularly with Stephen Hadley, who was the deputy national security advisor while Condoleezza Rice was the national security advisor. Now, of course, he is the national security advisor himself. He says, what you're doing is nuts. You're trying to find common ground when often there is no common ground, and you're sending people away for months and months to write new memos, to come up with new attempts to reach agreement. This isn't what the NSC is supposed to do. And so he is another of these guys who uses this word dysfunctional to describe the basic processes of decision-making inside the Bush administration.
David Rose is contributing editor at Vanity Fair. We're going to play a clip going back in time to January 2004 to a conversation that we had with Paul Krugman, the New York Times op-ed columnist, and Richard Perle, the man the Washington Post calls the intellectual guru of hardline conservative, neo-conservative movement in foreign policy, one of the fiercest critics against one of his fiercest critics, Paul Krugman. At the time, Richard Perle had just come out with a new book with David Frum called An End to Evil, How to Win the War on Terror. And I asked Richard Perle about his book.
Read our book. I haven't read his.
Richard
but
Perle.
We're not recommending what he suggests. We're not recommending going after every nasty dictatorship in the world. We're not recommending reinstating the draft or increasing the size of the army. What we are recommending is a sustained and concerted effort to isolate a relatively small number of terrorists and the states that support them before they can do even more damage than they did on September 11th. And I don't understand.
Well, let me ask. I mean, we're told that the book includes advocacy of regime change in Iran, that it calls for a blockade of North Korea. The book hasn't been available. Mine's been out for a while, but
well, it's hundreds of thousands of copies are out there. It calls for a blockade of North Korea if we are unsuccessful in stopping their production of nuclear weapons. The alternative is to leave them free to ship those weapons around the world. And I
let's just go back here. I mean, the point is, you know, stage one, the pilot project, was Iraq. There were many warnings from the professional military that the initial battles would be easy, but that the occupation was going to severely strain our military forces. And so it has turned out. Now,
sorry,
have we learned nothing from
100,000, we're going down to 100,000 troops in Iraq out of a uniformed military in excess of a million.
You know
I don't believe
that, right?
That
you know that every professional military person is talking about the extreme strain, that we have 40,000 soldiers who are on stop loss, who have not been given the freedom to leave when they normally would be able to. This is you know, but let's not minimize this. If you want to say this war was worth doing, fine, but to pretend that it was a low-cost venture, that's silly.
No, I didn't say it was a low-cost venture. I thought it was an essential venture, and I think we are emerging from it with an Iraq that has a future, and Iraq had no future before this war. But I don't appreciate the incorrect characterizations of what we say on regime change in Iran. That has nothing to do with the United States Army or our military forces. We are proposing that we give support to the millions of Iranians who don't want to have every aspect of their lives dictated to by a handful of mullahs who, you may have noticed, in the last 24 hours have been blocking any possibility of reform in that country through the electoral process. Should we not be identifying with people who want to liberate their country in this case?
Well, big difference between, I look forward to reading the book, but let me just come back to this. An awful lot of this discussion seems to be predicated on the notion that the United States has a level of power.
Paul Krugman.
It doesn't.
Well, I don't know what you mean when you say a lot of this discussion. We are very concrete and very specific about what we ought to do, and not everything that we advocate as a last step is or should be thought of as a first step. So, for example, with respect to North Korea, we encourage the effort.
An excerpt of a debate between Paul Krugman of the New York Times and Richard Pearl. Our guest in the Oxford studio in England is David Rose, contributing editor at Vanity Fair. His latest article is entitled Neo Culpa. David Rose, Richard Pearl, though he doesn't deny what he said to you, talking about the situation now in Iraq as a result of Bush administration's mishandling is a major problem. He's very angry that you have published this before the midterm election and says he was lied to. Your response?
Well, I regret he says that. The truth is, I told him and the other people I interviewed that the article would be published, as indeed it will be, in the January issue of Vanity Fair, which, of course, comes out, I think, on December the 6th. What I didn't realize is that there is now the capability at Vanity Fair to publish things more quickly, and I turned in my piece at the end of last week on Thursday. The editors read it and decided that it contained material that was so important that although it wouldn't be available in print for another few weeks, they should put it out on the internet in a shortened, abridged form. And I think they believed, they've stated this very firmly, that it was in the public interest for the American people to know what, at least the gist of what was in those interviews. And so that's the decision they took. Well, I certainly didn't give any undertakings to anybody that the article or part of the article would be published after the midterm or only after the midterm elections. It's fair to say that I believed at that stage that it would be, but the question of the elections themselves just didn't come up. I must say, I have been surprised at the strength of the reaction that some of these individuals have had. They have stood very firmly behind the cause of establishing democracy in Iraq and elsewhere. But from their reaction to the fact that the magazine did put out these excerpts from the article early, before the midterm elections, they seem to be saying that democracy in America is somehow less important, that it's okay for them to express their views when it's too late to affect the result at the ballot. But not okay to let voters actually have those views in their minds when they vote today. And I do find that disappointing.
David Rose, you wrote an earlier piece, and we had you on at the time, the question of did Speaker Hastert accept Turkish bribes to deny Armenian genocide and approve weapon sales? You wrote a piece for Vanity Fair. Today, Americans are making a decision, basically, about whether Dennis Hastert will run the Congress. They will decide the balance of the House of Representatives, and if Democrats win, he will no longer be Speaker of the House. Any further thoughts on that issue and a summary of the investigation that you did earlier?
Well, that, of course, was an article published last year about the case of Sybil Edmonds, who was a translator who worked for the FBI after 9/11, who listened to wiretap recordings made of a number of individuals, wiretaps of various targets who were working in the Turkish embassy and elsewhere that the FBI thought might be a threat to national security or involved in criminal activity. Now, what the article reported was that one of the investigations that she was asked to work on involved recordings made of individuals who claimed that they had bribed Speaker Hastert with both covert campaign donations and using other methods to transfer money in favor for his withdrawing the Armenian Genocide Resolution, which at that stage was about to pass through the House. It had passed through two preliminary stages. Now, I think the extraordinary thing about that story is that it is not ever being contested that there was an FBI investigation which did pick up allegations made by these Turkish targets, targets who, you know, were judged to be security risks by the FBI, making these allegations about Speaker Hastert. I have never claimed that those allegations had substance, that they were true, because I simply cannot say. It's impossible to prove it one way or the other. But it is clear that there were recordings made by the FBI in which individuals claimed to have given illegal payments to the Speaker in return for political favours. And I was always slightly surprised and indeed, again, disappointed that the rest of the American media didn't pick up on that and didn't perhaps try to take it further, because it does seem to me to be an important issue.
Finally, David Rose, you wrote the book Guantanamo, America's War on Human Rights. Do you think, since you've written that book, that this has become an issue that has been taken up anymore and has affected not only international perception of the United States, but Americans' perceptions of themselves?
Well, that book was published about 2 years ago, and there's no doubt at all that the whole issue of Guantanamo, torture, interrogation methods and so forth has become a subject of wider public debate in the United States. And as that has happened, I think it's also fair to say that the U.S. has garnered additional international opprobrium as a result of what has emerged. I have to say what dismays me more than anything is the Military Commissions Act, which passed through the Congress just recently, was signed into law by President Bush last month. Although at the time the rearguard action fought by senators such as John McCain and Lindsey Graham was trumpeted as a victory for the Geneva Conventions, it's extremely clear that that act is nothing of the kind. What the Military Commissions Act does is enshrines into law all the most abusive practices perpetrated by the United States since 9/11. Detention, in many cases for many years at a time without trial, recourse to highly coercive and abusive methods of interrogation, which in any other state would be called torture, pure and simple. And finally, a trials process at those military commissions due to be held at Guantanamo, which does not conform to any recognized standard of due process, either as set out by the United States Constitution or as recognized in other mature democracies. I hope that the Congress, if it does change hands today, will revisit the Military Commissions Act. And I further hope that the Supreme Court will eventually strike down its more obnoxious positions, because I find that that act is one of the most baleful events in the recent history, a long and baleful history since 9/11, in which the U.S. has really, I think, made some very grave missteps in its abuse of human rights in fighting the war on terror.
And finally, David Rose, is there much attention being paid in Britain to the American elections today?
Enormous attention. It's leading the news, has been very prominent on the news really for weeks now. Clearly people see that these are the most important midterm elections for many years. Arguably, they're rather more important than those midterms of 1994, which saw that Newt Gingrich revolution, because actually the lesson of those midterms was that it didn't last very long. I think people in Britain, especially those who follow American events more closely, can see that a huge amount may flow from these elections, perhaps a reassessment of critical aspects of America's foreign policy, and also major decisions that may affect the tenor of life in America itself for many years to come. And of course, I'm thinking here particularly about the appointment of federal judges and perhaps Supreme Court justices. I think it's fair to say that there is more attention focused on these midterms in Britain and indeed the rest of Europe than on any for a good many years.
David Rose, I want to thank you very much for being with us, contributing editor at Vanity Fair. His latest article is entitled Neo Culpa, speaking to us from Oxford University in Britain. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, as we head south to Nicaragua. Sandinista leader Daniel Ortega has a clear lead in the country's presidential election, with votes tallied from more than 60% of polling stations. Ortega has over 39% of the vote, nearly 8 percentage points ahead of his conservative Washington-backed rival Eduardo Montealegre. Ortega needs to win at least 35% and hold a lead of 5 points to take victory in the first round and avoid a runoff. He's expected to be confirmed as the winner with a final batch of returns today. As results trickle in, thousands of Sandinista Party supporters celebrated in the streets of Managua Monday night. Montealegre dismissed the partial results, saying he would face Ortega in a runoff. He also highlighted what he called voting irregularities, saying, quote, in a democracy, that is unacceptable. But international observer teams declared declared that the election was orderly and lawful. The race has drawn heavy attention from the Bush administration. The White House has threatened economic sanctions and withdrawal of aid if voters elect Ortega. The former president is trying to regain power for the first time since 1990. In recent weeks, a number of current and former U.S. officials have warned about the consequences of an Ortega victory. Oliver North recently traveled to Nicaragua and said a victory by Daniel Ortega would be the worst thing for Nicaragua. Our next guest, Roberto Vargas, is a veteran Nicaraguan diplomat. He served as chargé d'affaires in Washington, D.C., director of the North American Directorate at the Foreign Ministry in Managua, and finally Nicaraguan ambassador to China. He joins us on the phone from San Antonio, Texas. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much. Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. You were not always supporting Daniel Ortega in this race. Is that right?
Yes. Right. We've had differences in regards to what's happened to the party internally over the last years. So that consequently, I just kind of dropped out. I was supporting an old friend, Herty Levites, who frankly had a pretty good vision of what should happen, you know, now, currently in the Nicaraguan society, given, you know, the current politics in Latin America. So that, yes, we were looking forward to having a new face for, you know, the Sandinista Party. So I was moving with Herty at the beginning of the year until Herty died July 3rd this year.
Roberto Vargas, we're going to go to break and then come back to you. Again, Roberto Vargas is a veteran Nicaraguan diplomat, served with the Sandinistas from 1979 to 1991, now is in San Antonio, Texas, looking at the what looks like the victory of Daniel Ortega as the next president of Nicaragua. We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest in San Antonio, Texas, is Roberto Vargas, a veteran Nicaraguan diplomat from 1979 to 1991, Nicaragua's ambassador to China. When were you the ambassador to China, Roberto Vargas?
frankly, that was during the Miss Julieta Chamorro's tenure. That was like the beginning of 1990. I spent several months there. You know, after we had the transition, the government transition after the elections, where, you know, Daniel lost, obviously, and Ms. Chamorro. And I was asked, you know, by my party at the time, the FSLN, to continue, you know, that we should, if we were asked to continue the post, that we should look at it as professionals and in the interest of Nicaragua to stay. So I did. And, you know, Ms. Chamorro's government, I guess they looked and saw that my expertise with the United States, so they sent me to China, which we called the Golden Exile, Exilio Dorado. But it was an extremely important time. And again, that was during the right after the elections, 1990.
Let me ask you about the U.S. involvement in this election. You had Oliver North, who went down and was trying to convince people not to vote for Daniel Ortega. You had Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense. He insisted he wasn't getting involved in the politics of another country. As he said, he doesn't get involved in the politics of our own country. But your response?
Okay, in terms of the overall entourage, the parade of U.S. Diplomats, delegates, officials, etc., that went through Nicaragua in the last several months leading up to the race. We had, of course, Dan Burton of California. We had Matt Zelek. We've had, again, you pointed out Oliver North, who was the most obvious, and all of these different people, Carlos Gutierrez, and all of them in unison were calling for, you know, people not to vote for Daniel Ortega, that they were going to go back to the 80s when, you know, we were faced with Reagan's war. And I think North's presence underlined all of that that time. And I think it somehow had a boomerang effect on the people, those who were really not decided how they should vote. You know, I think that kind of pushed them over the edge. In particular, last Wednesday and Thursday, Mr. Hoekstra, what is his name? Mr. Rohrabach, Dana Rohrabach from California, insisted on calling
the congressman.
Rohrabach. Rohrabacher insisted that Chertoff look into it through the Homeland Security and how to withhold the remittances, which by different estimates, you know, like provide millions, some people say up to 400 million to the economy of the Nicaraguan people, right? Now, that's I was looking at that the other day and thinking about the larger issue, right, the context of the larger issue right now, immigration. And family remittances, which in some estimates are like 40-something billion dollars going to Latin America from the Latin American citizens, the Latinos living in this country, immigrants, right? So that that is part of that larger issue where Tancredo from Colorado and recently Imhoff, all of these people are now signing on and calling for the withholding remittances. And that's I think also a boomerang effect, similar to what happened with stopping the Cuban Americans from going to Cuba, right? They weren't really involved in the politics, but their presence, they had license to go at least once a year. And that really threw that whole equation off in Miami with the younger Cubans particularly. So I think that this is a reminder, you know, that all of these people came aboard, Tancredos, Royce, Rohrabacher, that they're calling for further boycotts. Nicaragua currently is one of the poorest countries in the hemisphere, right, next to Haiti. So to start threatening us with that kind of inhumanity, continued inhumanity, similar to the boycott, the embargo they've had on Cuba, I think that it finally underlined what we're faced with again. When you have a country such as Venezuela that is providing tons and tons of oil, you know, coming into the port quietly, diesel fuel, fertilizer, tons and tons of support, and promises of further support. And on the other hand, you have the U.S. threatening more warfare, more economic warfare. I think the vote this weekend with 70% turnout, massive turnout, we can do the analysis on that, right? I mean, it's kind of obvious. There was a big fear attempt, fear tactics, similar to what they do here in this country. But the results are in, and I think Nicaragua is saying something very clearly to the U.S. government, to the U.S. officials who attempted to threaten us. And the vote is clear. We want change. And we think that Daniel Ortega is the one that's going to lead that change.
Roberto Vargas, I wanted to ask you about the Bush administration threatening economic sanctions if Ortega wins. In an interview with the Nicaraguan newspaper La Prensa, the U.S. Embassy spokesperson Kristen Stewart said, quote, If a foreign government has a relationship with terrorist organizations, like the Sandinistas did in the past, U.S. law permits us to apply sanctions. Again, it will be necessary to revise our policies if Ortega wins. That is Kristen Stewart. Your response?
Again, that's part of the fear tactics that were used, very blatant, very obvious fear tactics. And again, this is their response. The Nicaraguan people responded completely to the contrary. You know, they demonstrated that we've had enough. We were frightened off in the 90 elections. People thought that by voting against Ortega that we might have a change where the a respite where the U.S. would stop their funding of the Contras, where we would probably have some kind of economic respite, where we would have development programs and et cetera, you know, and 16 years proved to the contrary. We're still poorer than ever, and the rich got richer. You see some interesting development, new hotels, a lot of business coming in, but again, not trickle down to the masses who live on $2 a day, maybe, in Nicaragua. So yes, to threaten us further with economic sanction like that, I mean, it was the end of it. It was like a death sentence, and Nicaragua doesn't need to depend on that kind of a system, an economic and political system that keeps threatening your very existence, all of the people, just like they've done to Cuba for all of these decades, where they don't think of the people of the island. They're thinking because of Fidel Castro, as they say, they're going to starve out the people of Cuba. Well, they've been trying to do that with Nicaragua as well. And the people, yeah, responded in another way.
Roberto Vargas, we're coming up on the 20th anniversary of the Iran-Contra affair. Oliver North, central to that during the Reagan-Bush years, illegally selling weapons to Iran, skimming off the profits and giving them to the Nicaraguan Contras, who were responsible for the deaths of thousands of Nicaraguans, despite the congressional ban, the Boland Amendment, that said the Contras could not be supported. The significance of this coming at the same time, and some of the same people today being in office in the United States who were deeply involved with this, like Elliot Abrams, John Negroponte was involved. Yours, right. Yes.
Well, I think that it's interesting that this is the Reagan, a continuation of the Reagan rollback, you know, of the popular resistance and popular movements in Latin America. But I think many of us have said that evolution is a process, right? You don't do it overnight by decree. Even elections sometimes will change the course for a while, but if there's a true and deep-seated need for that transformation, that social transformation, that they will continue. And I believe this is an expression of that, where the revolutions and the transformations were held back, but you know, we saw what's happening now. We have another opportunity to come back a different way, a different time, but the change is desperately needed in Nicaragua. We've got to it's just for our basic survival, we've got to change now, and the U.S. has demonstrated throughout the centuries that it's not providing for our survival or for our development for anything, rather than for what they did with the support of Somoza regime for 44 years, right? And the current support that they've got in other areas for dictators and in the name of national interest. So that, yes, we want to have peaceful and respectful and commercial relations with the United States, but we cannot accept the kind of hegemony that they've exerted on us for decades.
Roberto Vargas, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Veteran Nicaraguan diplomat under the Sandinistas, as well as the successive Chamorro government in Nicaragua, talking about what looks like the imminent win of Daniel Ortega to be president again of Nicaragua. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, as we turn now from elections in Nicaragua to elections right here at home in the United States. With new registration rules, faulty computer voting machines, and stringent identification requirements, many Americans are concerned over whether their vote will count. Well, three major civil rights groups have formed a new coalition to offer voters some Election Day assistance. The Election Protection Coalition is sending monitors to voting centers across the United States. They've also established a toll-free hotline for voters to call in case they experience problems at the polls. The coalition is led by People for the American Way, the NAACP, and the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Barbara Arnwine joins us on the phone right now. She's executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, part of this coalition, on the phone from Baltimore, Maryland. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Barbara Arnwine.
Well, good morning, and thank you so much.
It's good to have you with us. People are already going to the polls. What have you heard, and how are you protecting the elections today?
Well, we have over 2,000 lawyers spread over 19 states, making sure that we can respond as necessary, either with litigation, either with working interfacing with election officials, going to polling sites, correcting problems all over those 19 states, several counties. We're also running the nationwide hotline, the 1-866 Our Vote hotline, 1-866 Our Vote, 1-866-687-8683. We are receiving calls literally from all over the country. The hotline is just extremely busy. We're hearing the following problems. ID laws, they are causing major chaos throughout the country. Lots of confusion. A whole lot of states where there are no photo identification requirements, people are making folks produce photo IDs, even though there's no such requirement legally. Indeed, many people might have read that the Secretary of State of Missouri herself was requested to provide ID three times yesterday, even though she has their state does not require it at this time. Machine problems. Big problems. The most common problem we're hearing about is misregistration of votes, that when people vote for one candidate, it's saying the other candidate. That's a big problem all over the country. Polling places not opening. We've had that in Pennsylvania, some in Ohio. Illinois, believe it or not, has been one of our worst states this morning. And most of those problems are the lack of machines and and the refusal of poll workers to give provisional ballots as required by federal law. The other things we're seeing, again, is, you know, provisional ballots not being given in other states. We have gotten a lot of calls from the big states so far. It's been Pennsylvania, Illinois, Ohio dominates the hotline right now with the most problems. Maryland, Georgia, and Florida, those are the states that we're hearing from with a lot of issues.
And again, the phone number, it's 866-O-U-R-V-O-T-E.
That's correct.
Our Vote. And
Our Vote.
What kind of help can you give? People report a problem, but are you telling people how they can remedy the problem?
Oh, absolutely. What we do, and I mean, that's the whole purpose of the hotline, is to take care of the problems. We're not there just to make, you know, some kind of data entry. We want to help people. So what we're doing is that when voters are calling us, for example, when we got the call about the Prince George's County identification problem in Maryland, we have already sent lawyers there to talk with the poll workers and the election judges to make them stop that. And if they don't stop it, we will sue them today. I expect that it'll be resolved. We've been talking directly when people have been told that they're not registered. We've been talking directly to the poll workers and saying, listen, here's where we find your registration. You're wrong, and helping them to resolve that.
Barbara Arnwine, we're going to have to leave it there, but we hope to talk to you again tomorrow to get reports on what has happened. Again, that number, if you have any problem voting, is 866-OUR-VOTE, O-U-R-V-O-T-E. Barbara Arnwine, Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Hilton Kadush, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Huber Rich, and Aaron Mattei, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio, our engineers, at website democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.